The Years of Lyndon Johnson. Means of Ascent by Robert A. Caro. Continued. Cassette 12, Side 1. No parade greeted Lyndon Johnson when he got off the plane in Fort Worth this time. He was met by worried faces and big black headlines. Showdown Monday. At the Blackstone Hotel, he was ushered into a suite that had been hastily redecorated in modernistic decor for his visit, and he put on a confident front for reporters. He had a comfortable majority on the executive committee, he said, and he was sure he would receive the certification. But after the press filed out, he was handed a sheet of paper on which the names of the 55 members of the executive committee who were attending the convention had been divided into two columns according to the preferences they had expressed, one column for him, one for Stevenson. The list of names in Stevenson's column was longer, several names longer. The committee's ruling would probably be decisive, he was told. If it voted against him, his fight was over, his career was over, and it seemed that that was what the committee was likely to do. Just one vote difference there in the executive committee, and it was all over, Ed Clark recalls. One vote. If they had ordered Stevenson's name onto the ballot, there wasn't going to be much we could do. It was over. Recalling that night, Ed Clark stops talking and sits for long minutes behind his desk staring off into space, remembering. The state convention, he says at last, that was when I thought we might lose. Johnson's reaction to this news may never be known. Of those men who witnessed it, only two were alive when research on this book began, and no matter how frank these two, Ed Clark and George Brown, have been in describing other episodes in Johnson's life, neither wanted to talk about this one. Clark, who was intimately associated with Johnson for 30 years, and at his right hand in a score of crises in Texas, will say only, "I never saw him so worried about anything." Brown will say only, "He was wild." After some hours, he grew calmer. By the time Connolly saw him, he was, in Connolly's words, frantic but orderly. "Get me this one, get me that one," telephoning the executive committee members and the men back in the members' home counties who could influence them. He was calling all over the state to get pressure on the delegates any way he could. He interrupted his telephoning only to attend a barbecue for convention leaders, at which he arrived wearing a big smile and an air of confidence. Johnson's telephone calls were not the ones that mattered most, however. He needed all his big guns on the line now, and thanks to the planes at his disposal, he could get them there. Despite all the pressure Clark had exerted in East Texas, some executive committee members from the East Texas districts were still on Stevenson's side. Clark was in his room when Johnson called me and told me where to get a plane and pick up Ben Ramsey, the Texas Secretary of State, in San Augustine so he could be in on the trouble we had up there. Soon Ed Clark and Ramsey were prowling hotel corridors together, the two most powerful men in East Texas, trying to bring the East Texas members into line for Lyndon Johnson. And he had not just Clark and Ramsey, but the man behind Clark and Ramsey. He had wheeled up his biggest gun of all. Telephoning Herman Brown in Houston, he asked him to come in person. No one who knew Herman, and who was aware of his contempt for politicians and his distaste for politicians in groups, thought he would come. Herman Brown had never worked a convention in his life, his lobbyist Altorf says. But he worked this one. Herman knew them all, it seemed. He knew the district judges and the county commissioners from the counties in which he had done road contracting work long before there was a Mansfield dam, and if he didn't know the judge or the commissioner to whom a stubborn executive committee member might listen, he knew a subcontractor who did work for Brown and Root or who wanted to do work for Brown and Root in the future, who knew the judge or commissioner. He knew the legislators with whom he had dealt on the Manfred bills, and 100 other items, the men to whom he had sent envelopes filled with cash. And that night in Fort Worth, Herman Brown called in all his chits. It was necessary that he call them in, he told the recipients of his calls, because if Lyndon Johnson didn't win in the executive committee tomorrow, there might not be any more contracts or subcontracts. The full immense weight of the economic power of Brown and Root was thrown behind Lyndon Johnson that night. 3 of the 7 absent committee members were contacted by Herman Brown, and leaders in their counties were telephoned by Herman Brown, and then Herman Brown's plane went and collected the members, and there were 3 new votes for Lyndon Johnson. But Coke Stevenson's side was working the committee members, too, and working hard, and his side had legislative leaders and state officials and county officials who had had alliances with Coke through the long years, and all that night the fight went on. Johnson knew damn well that Stevenson had some real pros on his side, Altorf says. They might not have been working during the campaign, but they were working that night. Lyndon Johnson didn't sleep at all that night, and neither did his men. Midnight turned into 1 o'clock, and 1 o'clock into 2, and Lyndon Johnson's men worked the corridors and the bars in the big hotels. At 2 o'clock and 3, Ed Clark's big hand was on the shoulders of committee members. "That was the longest night," Clark says. "I was up all night, and Ben Ramsey was with me, and he was up all night." But no one knew which candidate was ahead. In this fight, the committee members were particularly anxious not to be joining the losing side. Recalls Clark, "People were asking me for a commitment that if they gave me their vote, they'd be on the winning side." But Clark had his code of honor. "I said, I cannot give that commitment." Some committee members were telling each side what it wanted to hear, so it was difficult to be certain even of some votes that had been promised. And as pressures and counter-pressures were brought to bear by both sides, votes kept shifting. "I knew we had turned around votes they still thought they had, and so I felt sure they had done the same to votes we still thought we had," Clark says. He was carrying around a list of the 58 potential voters, he recalls, and he had to keep switching names from one column to the other. "I just didn't know how it was going to go," he says. The only certainty in the Johnson camp, and in the hotel room in which Lyndon Johnson sat all night amidst the bright modernistic decor, in a shirt soaked with sweat, his face gray with fatigue and stubble, his eyes sunk in his head, hunched over a telephone and a list, was that, with those 3 new votes Herman Brown had flown in, it was going to be terribly close. Lyndon Johnson's fate was on the piece of paper lying on the desk in front of him. In that list, in which votes were counted not in tens of thousands, but one by one. And the list kept changing. Then it was Monday. Showdown Monday. As convention delegates and executive committee members were crowding into the Blackstone's high-ceilinged, dimly-lit Venetian ballroom at 10 a.m., the lobby outside was filled with more delegates and with tension. An elevator door opened and Lyndon Johnson stepped out, behind a phalanx of aides. His hair was slicked down so flat that it might have been pasted to his skull. The circles beneath his eyes were as dark as bruises. His skin, covered with nicks from the closeness of his shave, was sallow. As his entourage was pushing through the crowd, one of its members, Jerome Sneed of Austin, who was also a member of the executive committee, suddenly collapsed, gasping for breath and writhing in pain on the lobby floor from what appeared to be a heart attack. It was later diagnosed as ptomaine poisoning. Sneed was quickly surrounded by shouting, excited delegates, and by one man who was always calm, the man whose mind worked so fast. While other men knelt by Sneed's side and loosened his necktie and shouted for a doctor as he gasped in pain, Alvin Wirtz knelt by his side, scribbled something on a piece of paper, and, handing it to Sneed along with the pen, told him to sign it. It was his proxy. Wirtz had saved a Johnson vote. Johnson entered the ballroom in the midst of his aides, smiling, waving, and reaching out to shake hands. Stevenson had arrived early and was sitting quietly, puffing his pipe. As Johnson was passing Stevenson's seat, an enterprising newspaper photographer tried to persuade them to pose together. The two men were not far apart. "Just for a moment they looked like two dogs wanting to get at each other and held back by a leash," says a man who was between them. The moment passed. Stevenson's mask and Johnson's smile were back on. They turned away from each other, and Johnson and his entourage moved to another part of the big room. Pulling out a pack of cigarettes, Johnson lit one, drawing on it deeply. Oblivious for once to photographers, he put on his eyeglasses. After the 7 members of the canvassing subcommittee, 3 neutral, 2 representing Stevenson, 2, Wirtz and Amalie Holman of Taylor, representing Johnson, had been appointed, the ballroom was cleared, and at about 10:45 a.m. the subcommittee began its meeting there. At almost the same moment, the district court hearing began in Alice, so that for the next few hours, the 2 interlocking actions were proceeding simultaneously. During those hours, therefore, the pattern of Stevenson trying to open the Box 13 records and of Johnson trying to keep the records closed became clear, and so did the tactics, haste in Fort Worth, delay in Alice, by which Johnson's men were trying to accomplish his aims. In Fort Worth, Wirtz was attempting to hurry the subcommittee through its work. Stacks of big manila envelopes were piled on the stage of the Venetian Ballroom, the returns for 252 counties. Wirtz wanted to dispense with opening them. No sooner had the subcommittee meeting begun, with Democratic State Secretary Van M. Kennedy reporting that on purely arithmetical grounds, Johnson had indeed won by the 87 votes previously reported, then Wirtz moved that the subcommittee, without any further deliberations, certify those figures as official and report to the full executive committee that Johnson was the nominee. And when this motion failed, the subcommittee's three neutral members agreeing with Stevenson's representatives that it was their function to canvass the election county by county, Wirtz kept urging the canvassing along. One of those manila envelopes contained the Jim Wells return, the return based on the tally sheet on which the 7 had allegedly been changed into a 9, the return which had given Johnson the 87-vote majority. At the moment, it was the only Jim Wells return. If the Jim Wells committee met and authorized one of its members to telephone the subcommittee and say that the return was being corrected, anything could happen. Once the subcommittee reached Jim Wells in its canvassing and made the old return official, the danger of a new certification would be over. But the subcommittee was going through the envelopes alphabetically, and there were 122 counties between Johnson and safety. So Wirtz hurried the subcommittee along, and when the Jim Wells return was finally reached and Stevenson's representatives showed some disposition to discuss it, Wirtz said, in a statement with which the neutral members agreed, that they could not do so. So long as the court restraining order was in effect, he said, the subcommittee was prohibited not only from changing the Box 13 vote, but from investigating it, even, in fact, from discussing it. In Alice, meanwhile, Johnson's representative, Attorney Dudley Tarleton, was working to keep that restraining order in effect, at least until the subcommittee had finished its work. So as speed was the order of the day in Fort Worth, delay was the order in Alice. Stevenson attorney Wilbur Matthews considered the case so clear-cut that he thought the hearing in Alice wouldn't take long. No court should stop the Jim Wells committee from opening the records, investigating the returns, and, should the findings justify such an action, revising the returns. And he said nothing could be clearer. To support his view, Matthews read passages from the authoritative Texas jurisprudence, which said flatly that because intra-party primary elections were not open to all voters but only to members of a political party, disputes in it were to be considered intra-party matters, of which courts are not to take cognizance. What could be clearer than that, he asked. Judge Archer's restraining order, he said, has no parallel in the judicial history of the United States, and no justification under Texas law. It should be dissolved at once. Tarleton's presentation was somewhat longer. He read, in what Matthews considered a deliberate manner, Judge Archer's order and Johnson's petition asking for the order. He read at length from the primary election statutes. Then he started in on various court decisions. It was evident, Matthews was to write, that he was stalling for time. He was still reading when Judge Broder called a 2-hour recess for lunch, and he was still reading when court resumed after the recess. Tarleton's recitation may have been unnecessary. Early in the court proceedings that morning, an extra-legal occurrence had convinced Stevenson's attorneys, had any further convincing been needed, of the slimness of their chances of having the order vacated. The occurrence was the arrival in court of George Parr. Striding past the benches where other spectators sat, he pushed through the low-swinging door into the section of the courtroom customarily reserved for attorneys and sat down at the table with Johnson's attorneys, relaxed and at ease, as if he owned the courtroom, which, of course, many of the persons watching him felt he did. His nonchalance slipped only once. During a recess, the Duke of Duval was expansive and smiling as he explained to newsmen that the reports about his political influence were untrue. "You don't control votes," he said. Then a question, an innocuous one, annoyed him, and for just a moment the reporters saw the true face of George Parr. "He stopped short," one wrote. "His eyes seemed to pierce his glasses, and his smile and hearty laughter were replaced by what the reporter described as a resolute expression." After the recess, he returned to the attorney's table, where he bent his gaze on Judge Broder. But despite Parr's presence, there was always a possibility of a miscarriage of the ducal brand of justice. always a possibility that the judge might rule for Stevenson and vacate the restraining order. Members of the County Democratic Committee, including Adams and Poole, were in the courtroom, hoping to be allowed to look at last into Box 13. So Tarleton took no chances. He delayed as long as was necessary, and his tactics served their purpose. At 2:30 p.m., a newspaper man brought a wire service bulletin into court. Reports conflict on its contents, but it appears to have stated that the canvassing subcommittee had reached Jim Wells County in its tabulations. "It's too late," Matthews told Judge Broder. "Dissolving the restraining order would no longer serve any purpose." "This case is moot and should be dismissed," he said in disgust. Broder did not dismiss the case. "I am not saying that there was fraud or that there was not fraud," the judge said. "If it so happens that our laws do not set out adequate means and speedy procedures to correct illegal acts, I regret it. But I do not make the laws." At 3 p.m., a rumor swept the courtroom that the subcommittee was refusing to certify the Jim Wells returns and was waiting to hear what the court ruling was. Broder thereupon gave the ruling. It was in favor of Johnson. The judge said he did not see how granting Johnson's request for an injunction would interfere in any way with an election contest. Therefore, he said, he was continuing the injunction until such a contest was filed or until the present case was heard on its merits. Until that time, no change could be made in the Box 13 tabulations. "The case failed in the face of the power of George Parr," Matthews was to write. Delay had been Johnson's purpose, and that purpose had been served. When the subcommittee had reached Jim Wells, there had been no new certification for them to look at. Up in Fort Worth, however, Lyndon Johnson was now to receive a most unpleasant shock. His attorneys had assured him that in the absence of a new certification from Jim Wells County, the canvassing subcommittee would have no choice but to accept the old one and send his name to the executive committee as the party's senatorial nominee. But suddenly, without warning, the subcommittee was refusing to do so. When, with the county-by-county tabulation completed, Alvin Wirtz moved that the subcommittee certify Johnson's 87-vote majority, one of Stevenson's two representatives on the 7-member subcommittee, retired Major General Albert Sidney Johnson, objected. Declaring that the 87-vote majority included at least 202 clearly illegal votes from Jim Wells County, he moved to amend Wirtz's motion. His amendment would certify the returns from 251 counties, but not the Jim Wells returns. "The question of the correct and legal vote of Jim Wells should be submitted to the full executive committee," he said, "and until that correct and legal vote was ascertained, that county's votes should not be included in any tabulation." Without those votes, Coke Stevenson was the party's nominee. Johnson jumped to his feet. Grabbing his sleeve, Wirtz pulled him down, and he and another of Johnson's attorneys, Charles I. Francis, made Johnson's argument, Francis almost screaming at subcommittee chairman W.B. Simmons, that with a court injunction in force, for this or any other committee to refuse to accept the vote as now certified would be violating that injunction. Simmons, however, ruled that the subcommittee could vote on General Johnson's amendment. Wirtz and Mrs. Holman voted against it, as did one of the subcommittee's neutral members, but the other neutral member voted with Stevenson's two representatives. With the vote tied 3-3, Simmons cast the deciding vote. It was for General Johnson's amendment, which thus carried 4-3 and became the subcommittee's majority report. Wirtz announced that he would make his motion a minority report, but that was what it was, a minority report. Johnson had been confident that if only his attorneys could stall long enough down in Alice, he would emerge from the subcommittee meeting bearing its imprimatur as the party's nominee and with the 200 indispensable votes from Jim Wells firmly certified as his. The stalling had worked, but not the rest of his strategy. He would be going into the crucial executive committee meeting with neither of those two advantages. The vote had been taken at 5:00. The meeting of the executive committee would begin at 7:00. Now everything hinged on the executive committee. Several alternatives were available to it. It could adopt its subcommittee's majority report and conduct its own investigation of the Jim Wells returns. It could adopt the subcommittee's minority report and name Lyndon Johnson the nominee. Or it could disregard both reports and simply name a nominee, Johnson or Stevenson. Whatever the exact wording of the resolution on which it finally voted, the 58 members of the committee present in Fort Worth would in reality simply be choosing between the two men who had fought so long for the nomination. And still, as 7:00 neared, no one knew whom the committee was going to choose. Committee members were still switching back and forth. Others, afraid of being caught on the losing side, were saying they would abstain or were telling each side what it wanted to hear. George Brown asked his brother how it was going to go that night. His brother said he didn't know. All he knew, he said, was that it was going to be very close. Even as Ed Clark, weary from more than 36 consecutive hours of counting votes, was walking down to the ballroom for the meeting, he wasn't sure what the actual count was going to be. As he walked, he pulled out the rumpled sheet of paper on which he had been doing his figuring and counted up votes for the last time. "I had it figured as a tie," he says. Spacious though it was, the Venetian ballroom wasn't nearly spacious enough to hold all the politicians who wanted to be present. Every seat, of course, was taken, and it seemed every foot of floor space, too. It was very hot. Perspiration rolled down the faces of burly men with big cigars. By the time the meeting began, the ballroom seemed already filled with smoke, who were jammed so tightly together that they tried in vain to keep their expensive Stetsons from being crushed. Women members of the executive committee kept dabbing their faces with handkerchiefs that were already sodden. "The whole atmosphere was tension," recalls the man who presided at the meeting, State Democratic Chairman Robert Calvert. "Some of the spectators were there simply out of a desire to be present at one of the most dramatic moments in Texas political history. But others, those who were adherents of Lyndon Johnson and Coke Stevenson out of ideology or personal affection, or who had personal stakes in the outcome of the vote, had deeper interests. Standing in the ballroom that evening were Jake Pickle and Raymond Buck, and Fred Korth and John Connolly, men who had, some of them many years before, tied their fortunes to Lyndon Johnson's star. Those men would remember their feelings until they died. I was leaning up against a pillar in the back, listening and trying to make tabulations, but my heart was pounding so much that I could hardly write," Pickle recalls, "because I knew what was involved." Johnson had a lot of his men present. Wavering committee members anxious to be with the winner might be swayed at the last moment by an impression as to who the winner was going to be. He was loudly cheered as he and Lady Bird walked to the seats that had been saved for them by two of his men in the front row and sat down facing the committee. He smiled until he felt the ovation had gone on long enough. Then he lifted his hand, palm out, and the cheers stopped as abruptly as if he had turned off a faucet. "Is Coke here?" spectators asked each other. Then the former governor was noticed, sitting inconspicuously in the middle of the audience. Stevenson's lead attorney, Clint Small, a former district judge, focused on what the Stevenson forces considered the main question: whether or not a single precinct, a boss-dominated precinct notorious for the block pattern of its voting, was to be the decisive factor in a statewide election. "The issue," said Small, "is whether or not Precinct 13 in Jim Wells County is to elect a United States senator." And the attorney said the issue was whether or not that single precinct was to elect a senator with votes that were patently illegal. Lyndon Johnson, he said, was trying to get the Senate office with votes of people who never appeared at the polls. Every name that appears after 8:41 has been placed there after the closing of the polls. Small said he was prepared to prove his charge. Although access to the voting lists had been illegally denied, the names of some persons alleged to have voted had been taken down. Affidavits had been obtained from those persons. Johnson's claque was heckling and booing Small now in an attempt to drown him out, but Small read aloud the affidavits, in which each of the voters swore he had not voted. As he finished reading one, he asked the executive committee, "Are you going to put a man in the United States Senate on that vote?" They cold-bloodedly added the 202 votes that are deciding this Senate race. "Don't count votes put in 4 or 5 days after the ballots were counted." Yelling above the shouts of Johnson's claque, Small told the committee, "This, the Jim Wells certificate, reeks with corruption and fraud. They will say you have to take it whether it is good or bad. You don't have to take a certificate when you know it is false." Opening the arguments for Johnson, John Cofer of Houston, one of the most renowned of the stem-winding, arm-waving school of courthouse lawyers, roared, "I believe in justice and right." During his arguments, together with those of Charles Francis of Brown and Root and Ed Lloyd of the Duchy of Duval, it became apparent, however, that their substance was rather that justice and right had no relevance to the work of the executive committee. Determining the legality of ballots, Johnson's lawyers said, in an argument which weighed heavily with many committee members, was the function of the state's district courts. It was, in fact, Francis said, contrary to law for the committee to determine legality. Under state law, the committee's sole function was to add up the voting totals sent in by the individual counties. You are here only to count the votes, Cofer shouted, pounding the air with both fists. You may or may not be able to understand law, but by the holy writ you can count. Turning to Coke Stevenson as he sat puffing his pipe, Francis jabbed a finger at him and said, Coke Stevenson, if you don't think those votes were fair and accurate, you can take Frank Hamer with his pistols and have your day in court. We'll meet you there. That is where the law says election contests should be held. To rebel yells, shouts of pour it on, and applause from supporters, Johnson smiled, then waved his hand for quiet. As for affidavits, he had affidavits too, Cofer said. Are you going to let Mr. Small wave an affidavit and then let me wave one? He asked. Well, I can wave two for every one he can wave. He would not, however, do so at this time, Cofer said, because the place for affidavits was in court. Furthermore, Small's affidavits were worthless, Johnson's attorney said, because they'd been obtained by intimidation and threats during what Lloyd termed an invasion of his beloved Jim Wells County by goon squads, which had terrorized innocent people. The goon squads, Lloyd said, were Stevenson's lawyers and Frank Hamer. Ignoring the fact that Hamer had not been present when any of the affidavits were obtained, he and Stevenson had been on their way back to Austin at the time, Cofer bellowed, He, Stevenson, went down there to Alice with a man who had a gun on his hip and said to these people, swear to this. None of you would try a Negro on the basis of affidavits obtained by a policeman with a gun on his hip. The remainder of the arguments by the three attorneys on the affidavits also had racial overtones. You're not going to deprive him, Johnson, of this election on affidavits obtained from Mexicans, Cofer said. You just take a number, pick you a Mexican, and let him make an affidavit. For 3 hours, the lawyers held forth in the sweltering, smoke-filled ballroom. Stevenson sat impassively. Johnson was hunched forward, one elbow resting on a knee, his face supported by his hand. His nervous fingers pinched and pulled the skin on his cheek, tore at the flesh around his fingernails. He was lighting one cigarette from the butt of another, and sometimes he bent over, sucking in the soothing smoke for a long minute. But only for a minute. Then he would be hunched forward again, his eyes flickering around the room, watching everything, but mostly staring at the faces of the committee men and women, trying to guess his fate. The voting began at 9:48 p.m. The vote was on a motion to adopt the minority report Wirtz had drafted in the subcommittee instead of adopting the subcommittee's majority report, so an aye vote would be a vote that the executive committee certified Johnson as the nominee. A no vote would in effect be for Stevenson's certification. At the beginning, the votes were mostly for Stevenson, including several from executive committee members Johnson had believed favored him. Men who were watching Lyndon Johnson would never forget how he sat there rigid and unmoving, appearing almost stunned as the voting continued. No, no, no. After 31 votes had been cast, Stevenson had 21 to his 10. Then the tide changed, and vote after vote, including several that Johnson had believed would be for Stevenson, were for him. The vote was tied and then tied again, this time at 28-28, and then the last vote was called, and it was for Johnson. He had won, 29-28. Pandemonium enveloped the ballroom. Men pounded Lyndon Johnson on the back. Women pushed through the crowd to hug and kiss him. Cheers and rebel yells drowned out Chairman Calvert's attempts to gavel enough order out of the chaos to announce the vote. In the din, no one noticed for some minutes that a committee member, Mrs. Seth Dorbrandt, who had voted for Johnson, was waving her arms and asking for the floor. Finally, as the noise was dying down in anticipation of Calvert's announcement, the chairman noticed Mrs. Dorbrandt and gave her the floor. She withdrew her previous aye vote for Johnson, saying she wanted to be recorded as present but not voting. She later told reporters that I believed by changing my vote it would make a tie and force the decision into the courts where I believe it rightfully belongs. The vote was tied again. Spectators shouted to Calvert to call again the names of the five committee members who had been absent during the balloting. One after another he called the names, and the first four, who had not come to Fort Worth, didn't answer. The fifth and last name was that of Charlie C. Gibson of Amarillo. Knowing that Gibson was in Fort Worth, John Connolly had been searching for him and moments earlier had finally found him. In later years, when the story of the executive committee vote would be encrusted with myth, some of those myths surrounded Gibson's disappearance during the voting. It was said he had been missing when his name was called either because he had a headache or had dozed off in another room or because he had gone to the bathroom. It was indeed in a bathroom that Connolly found him. but he says Gibson was not there in order to use its facilities, but because he had promised his vote to Johnson and now didn't want to be caught on the wrong side. What he was doing in the bathroom, Connolly says, was hiding. He knew it was going to be close, and he didn't want to vote. "God damn it, Charlie, get out there and vote," Connolly shouted. Just as Calvert was calling his name, Gibson burst into the room. "Aye," he shouted. Johnson again led 29-28. At that moment, Lyndon Johnson thought fastest. In the instant of silence that followed Gibson's "aye," before pandemonium could break loose again, he called to Calvert, "Announce the results now, Bob, before someone else changes his mind." Calvert did. Lyndon Johnson had won. The margin had been a single vote, but he had won. The full convention the next day, tumultuous though it was on the surface, and crucial though it was for Truman's chances of holding Texas, was an anticlimax in terms of realpolitik. The deal struck earlier between Wirtz and the Loyalists was consummated. Johnson's forces voted to seat not the Houston delegation that had won in May, but a Loyalist delegation from Houston, whereupon states' rights delegations from Dallas, Tarrant, and several smaller counties stalked out, in their bitterness taking with them microphones, speakers, podium, and even the organ, which had been rented by the host delegation. "As Tarrant goes, so goes the furniture," one headline read. Pro-Truman and pro-Johnson delegates swarmed into the Will Roberts Auditorium to take their places, thus giving the Loyalists overwhelming control of the convention. "Johnson's aides helped us on the seating," Eckert recalls. "In return, we took care of the Johnson crowd on the ballot boxes. We didn't open the boxes." The Loyalists voted to place on various party committees, including the new executive committee and the canvassing committee of the convention as a whole, men and women who would oppose any investigation of the Jim Wells vote. That canvassing committee, on which Stevenson supporters had pinned their last hopes, was now, in the words of one observer, a Mary Johnson party. "It's stacked 99% against us. What good would a fight do now?" a depressed Clint Small asked. And indeed, when the executive committee's minority report, the report charging Johnson with palpable fraud and irregularities, was presented to the convention's canvassing committee, it was ignored. One committee member moved to table it, another quipped, "Let's put it under the table," and there was general laughter. When that evening, at the convention's closing session, Governor Buford Jester tried to speak, he was interrupted by shouts of, "We want Johnson!" A party official read the executive committee's majority report, the one carried by the 29-28 vote, amid swelling applause. Then permanent chairman Tom Tyson called for an aye and no vote on the report, and there was a thunder of ayes. Then a roaring chant, "Johnson! Johnson!" The candidate and Ladybird had been waiting in the wings, and they were escorted to the speaker's platform to a tremendous roar. "He had had a hard fight, but he had won," he said. "This is the moment for which we have been waiting for 100 weary days. I am filled with so much gratitude towards my friends that there is no room for bitterness. The election is behind us. This is a great night for us. To all of you we say we love our friends, we forgive our enemies." The next morning, the Johnsons rose early, left the Blackstone, were driven to the airport and boarded a plane for the Gulf Coast to look on sand and water where there are no telephones. His aides, some of whom had been celebrating all night, were still celebrating. The morning's pro-Johnson newspapers exulted with them. The convention had been a field day for Lyndon Johnson, the Houston Post said. Hairbreadth Harry himself never experienced a more exciting run of adventures than those which brought to a hairbreadth photo finish climax the closest major political race in all Texas history. "And," said the Post, "the most exciting thing about it all, from Mr. Johnson's viewpoint, was its happy ending." Ending? The fight that had gone on so long had not ended at all. Chapter 15. Qualities of Leadership. In believing that the struggle with Coke Stevenson was now over, Lyndon Johnson and his aides, and Stevenson's aides as well, were not reckoning with the deepening sense of injustice the former governor had come to feel, or with the implications of this feeling for a man with so fervent a belief in the law. Stevenson believed that an election had been stolen from him. That in itself was infuriating. But then, after he had set out to retrieve what had been stolen, after he had gone to Alice and obtained the evidence which he believed proved the theft, He had been told that, evidence notwithstanding, the law provided no recourse against that theft. Lyndon Johnson, Stevenson felt, had used the law against him, not the law in its majesty, but the law in its littleness. Johnson had relied on its letter to defy its spirit. Stevenson had first sought justice from the people who knew the truth best, the Jim Wells Democratic Committee itself, and that committee had been willing to give him what he sought, to meet together and throw out the tainted ballots. But the law, in the form of the injunction Johnson had obtained from a George Parr court, had prevented the committee from doing so. Then he had sought justice from his party at a higher level, from its executive committee, and the law had stopped him there too, as Johnson's attorneys had convinced the committee that investigating the votes was contrary to the law. In that executive committee, Charles Francis had told him, shouting to his face, "You can have your day in court. We'll meet you there." Knowing even as he shouted that in the court to which he was referring, the state district court, no effective action was possible before the case was made moot, and that no other state court would accept jurisdiction until after the district court had ruled. After the 29-28 vote against him in the executive committee, Stevenson had still hoped that the full convention would deal with the palpable fraud and irregularities. And then had come the quip, "Let's put it under the table," and the roar of laughter from the men with whom Johnson had stacked the convention. To Stevenson's young attorney friend from Junction, that laughter was symbolic. "That whole week it was like Lyndon was laughing at Coke," Callan Graham says. "It was as if he was laughing in his face and telling him that he was so smart that the law couldn't touch him." During neither of these proceedings, neither at the executive committee nor in the court, did Lyndon Johnson or his lawyers deny what we were saying. Their argument in both cases was that it didn't make any difference legally. They were just saying that, true or not, we couldn't do anything about it. And indeed, when after the convention Stevenson met with his own attorneys in his hotel suite, most of them told him the same thing. And that was an argument that Coke Stevenson could not accept. He loved the law that he had taught himself on the ranch, loved it as he loved his land, loved it with an intensity so deep it was almost religious, believed in its majesty and its power to right a wrong. Now he had been told that the law was powerless to right the wrong that he felt had been done in this election. "For Coke, this just couldn't be true," says his nephew, Robert Murphy, "because if that was true, it would destroy something he had believed in all his life, something that was very important to him." He went out for a walk on the streets of Fort Worth, alone, and a reporter, encountering him, asked him if the long battle was now over. Coke Stevenson's big jaw came up. "Of course not," he said. "We're going to fight right on." And that night, while the convention was cheering Lyndon Johnson, and Johnson was celebrating and sleeping and then flying off for a vacation, Coke Stevenson was fighting. He and Dan Moody, another former governor, who had volunteered to serve as one of his attorneys, met for a while and decided that since there was no help available in the state courts, they would go to the federal courts. Moody said that because the primary involved a federal office, Stevenson could sue under the federal civil rights statute because he had been denied a civil right, the right to have the votes in the primary counted honestly. He could ask for an injunction or restraining order that would forbid the inclusion of Johnson's name on the November ballot, pending a full hearing in federal district court. And should that hearing show that Johnson had been elected by fraudulent votes, he could ask for an order placing his own name on it instead. Moody was too tired that night to draw up the necessary petition for a restraining order himself, but there was that young attorney who had written the report that the canvassing committee had so blithely ignored. Josh Gross was wakened in his hotel room by a telephone call. On the line was Coke Stevenson, whom he had never met, and Stevenson asked him to turn his report into a petition for an injunction. While Gross was doing this, Stevenson, with all his legal advisers gathered in his hotel room, discussed which of the three federal judges who sat on the United States District Court for the Northern District of Texas to present it to. There seemed no good choice. One of the three was irascible, erratic, a judge lawyers shied away from. The second was too much a brass-collar Democrat, one who would be eager to uphold the party's executive committee. The third, former Lieutenant Governor T. Whitfield Davidson, was noted not only for his formality in a courtroom, but as a strict constitutionalist who might be predisposed against permitting federal intervention in a state election. But Davidson, while a fervent Democrat, he had been one of Roosevelt's first prominent supporters in Texas, was also noted for his independence, and it was decided to present the petition to him. It had to be presented to him fast, before Johnson's name went on the ballot. Attorney Connie Renfro of Dallas telephoned Davidson's home and was told that the judge was vacationing on his sister's ranch, but no one seemed to know exactly where in Harrison, or perhaps Upshur County, the ranch was located. Renfro, leaving Fort Worth at midnight, spent all night driving around East Texas. Dawn was breaking before he found it. Braving a rather fierce-looking watchdog, he found the tiny white-haired judge already awake, brewing coffee, and learned that Davidson's insistence on the rules of court held firm even when the court was a ranch house kitchen. The judge pulled a table into the middle of the room and sat at it, as if behind a bench, had Renfro place a copy of the petition and proposed restraining order on it, studied them as Renfro read them aloud, and then at 6:25 a.m., Wednesday morning, he signed the restraining order, setting the following Tuesday, September 21st, for the hearing on whether to harden the order into an injunction. Speeding back to Fort Worth, Renfro filed the order with the clerk of the Federal District Court. Even as Lyndon Johnson was in a plane en route to his vacation, believing he was on the ballot at last, state election officials were being ordered to keep the Democratic line blank, at least until the hearing. Coke Stevenson went for another walk. He looked happier than he had for days. On September 21st, assured by his legal team that his argument against federal intervention in a state election was strong and that Davidson would be predisposed toward it, Johnson strode into federal district court in Fort Worth at the head of a long line of lawyers, deeply tanned and wearing a broad, confident smile. His hair was sleek and shiny with pomade. The dark blue of his suit's heavy, rich fabric was broken only by the silver star pin and the precise points of the white handkerchief in his breast pocket. His white shirt was gleaming and starched. His necktie had a bright floral print. The pearl-gray Stetson in his hand was a 20X beaver. His wife was dressed as he liked her dressed, complete to the long feather curling up from her fashionable pillbox hat. The crowd in the oak-paneled, high-ceilinged courtroom was a political crowd. In the audience were Speaker of the House W. O. Reed and other prominent state officials, Tom Clark's brother Robert and other political influentials, political reporters, even one of the candidates defeated in the first primary, Cyclone Davis. At the attorneys' tables sat political stars, not only Alvin Wirtz and Clint Small, but James Allred and Dan Moody, Allred, Moody, and Stevenson, three former governors of the state. As Johnson worked the crowded, noisy room, shaking hands, chatting in a relaxed manner, every inch the successful candidate, the scene seemed like a continuation of the convention that had so recently been held a few blocks away. But this wasn't a convention, but a courtroom very different from George Parr's courtroom in Alice. Just before Judge Davidson entered, a marshal told the men who had taken off their suit jackets to put them on, and then he called out, "No smoking, gentlemen." Coke Stevenson put out his pipe. Lyndon Johnson put out his cigarette. After the silver-haired jurist had taken the bench, in the words of one reporter, just radiating dignity in a quiet way, some of the attorneys, former governors and glittering political names, went on talking. "Now, gentlemen," the judge said, "I will ask you not to carry on any consultation in the courtroom. If it is necessary to direct attention to the next man, do it very quietly." The attorneys looked up at the judge and sat down. The talking stopped. Whatever the outcome of Coke Stevenson's petition would be, that petition was going to be heard in a setting very different from any in which his battle with Lyndon Johnson had previously been waged, in the setting Stevenson loved, not in a noisy, smoke-filled convention hall, but in a quiet, high-ceilinged courtroom, in a court not of politics, but of law. And as soon as Moody began his opening argument, every trace of a smile was gone from Lyndon Johnson's face. Moody's first sentences contained some news for Johnson. He said that Coke Stevenson was no longer charging election fraud merely in Jim Wells County. He was broadening his complaint. He was charging that fraud had also been committed in Zapata County, and he was broadening it still further into the county whose vote totals had been perhaps the most indefensible of all. Fraud had been committed, Moody said, in Duval County. He was therefore no longer talking about 200 votes, he said, but many more, thousands. In fact, he was to tell Davidson, "We expect to lay before this court testimony that will affect thousands of votes in this election." And, Moody said, he was prepared to prove what he was saying. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.